Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Redemption Hill podcast. We are a community of people learning the way of Jesus to bless our city of Boise, Idaho, and beyond. Redemption Hill is a unique place. We are a collective of micro churches that do life together throughout the week and gather on Sundays to grow, worship, and celebrate what God is doing in our city. You are invited to join us Sundays at 9 a.m. at Discovery Church in Boise, where you can find the community you need in any season of your life. More details can be found at redemptionboise.org. Up next is the teaching segment from this week's Sunday gathering. Afterwards, stay tuned for more information on how to get connected at Redemption Hill.
Hey guys. Good morning. Good morning. Okay, I like how Robert put that. This is a kids' church with an adult Sunday school class. That is essentially the breakdown of Redemption Hill. It's like a thunder cloud when they all leave here. I think everyone's back in. 9:55. Ready for a five-minute sermon? Good thing it's me, huh? No, you wish it was Andrew up here. We'll try to finish on time today. I cannot believe we sang that song about the... Where's Malia? Is she even in here? That song about the prodigal son, that's what I'm preaching about today, and I've never heard that song before. That really made me emotional when I heard that. If we don't know each other, my name's Jessie Horney, and I'm one of the pastors for our Redemption Hill family, and that was really exciting to see Vanessa and Adriana. We've all been in a discipleship huddle for the last couple of years with Taya, too, and Alyssa, and seeing someone's life be transformed to the point where they're willing to take on a brand new risky job is pretty wild. Like, I know I say this all the time, but there is no miracle less explainable than a changed human heart because people don't change, but Jesus changes people. So this fall, we're talking about why God, essentially. There's a lot of people in our community who are new to the faith, or people who, like Vanessa kind of explained, have deconstructed the faith of their childhood, maybe the faith of their teen years, maybe like the faith of their first marriage or whatever it was. And we want to provide a space to reconstruct, because we can't just stop at the tearing down, because really all you're left with is like a pile of rubble. But we believe that there is a way to rebuild and to understand what is true and right about who God is and who we are. That really launches next Sunday, so I'm just going to tell a few stories from Jesus this week and invite us to ask a few questions about what we believe about God and what we believe about ourselves. And then hopefully in the next 6 weeks when we come on Sundays, you guys saw my Instagram video. I've never done that before, been like, come to church. But I actually really, really think that this fall together is going to form something in us as a community that will propel us forward in the next few years of our life together. Oh, thanks, guys. Appreciate you joining us. Malia, I was just saying that I'm preaching about the prodigal son this week. So when you sing that song, I could not believe that. Yeah, that was so wild. Both of those songs, actually. But you've heard the story of the prodigal son before. Like, probably a lot of times. Probably from way better preachers than me. And so I want to start by just praying over that, okay? Like, Lord, we have heard this story. Even if we haven't been to church before, we know the term prodigal son. It is so seeped into our knowledge of what it means to be someone who runs away from family. But I know that you have something good for us today, because I have never, ever read your story and not seen something good about you. So, Holy Spirit, would you give us a fresh look today at an old story with familiar characters. And instead of seeing through it like a window, Lord, may we look into it like a mirror. Amen. So you can come with me to Luke 15. That's where we're going to be. This is right in the middle of Jesus telling a bunch of stories. It's like the travel narrative. He's heading to Samaria, and he's talking to people on the road as he goes, which we love about Jesus. He did preach in church, but most of the time when he talked to people, it was just on the road. Also, I'm going to use this clicker today, which makes me feel like this is a TED Talk, but you will not be sold anything, and your life may not be changed at the end, but I have a clicker. I'm going to be reading out of the NLT translation, and I'm actually going to start with the stories before. So Jesus is walking with a bunch of different people, tax collectors, and other notorious sinners who often came to listen to Jesus teach. And this made the Pharisees and teachers of religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. Gross. So because of that, Jesus tells them this story. If a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go to search for the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he's found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, because I have found my lost sheep." In the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. So there's story number one. We're going to see four stories. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Won't she light a lamp and sweep the entire house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she will call in her friends and neighbors and say, "Rejoice with me, because I have found my lost coin." In the same way, there is joy in the presence of God's angels when even one sinner repents. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. Okay, a man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your estate now, before you die." So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. And a few days later, this younger son, classic, packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land. And there he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him out into his fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. And when he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, "At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I'll go home to my father and say, 'Father, I have sinned against both you and heaven. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant.'" So he returned home to his father. Best verse of the Bible. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. And filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. And his son said to him in his rehearsed speech, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son." But his father said to the servants, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet, and kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found." So the party began. Meanwhile, the older son, of course, was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants what was going on. "Your brother's back," he was told, "and your father has killed the fattened calf. We're celebrating because of his safe return." The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him, but he replied, "All these years, I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to do. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fattened calf." His father said to him, "Look, dear son, you've always stayed by me, and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead and has come back to life. He was lost, and now he is found." This feels like three stories: the sheep, the coin, and the boys. But really, it's four stories: the sheep, the coin, the boy, and the boy. Because there's two very different things happening between the father and the sons. And it's important for us to recognize that there are four ways that someone or something is being pursued in these stories. And there's something really interesting happening as Jesus tells these stories to Eugene Peterson points this out in a book, and I thought this was really interesting, that like the story really narrows in on like intensity, because you start with 100 sheep and one is lost, still important. But then you get down to 10 coins and one is lost. So you went from 1 and 99 to 1 and 9. But then we get down to the story of the boys, and it's just the two. And now we've lost one of two things that we love. And then in the fourth story, it's just one and one. It's just the father and the older son. This is important because we want to sense the intensity of what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees and these wretched sinners that Jesus dares to eat with, because there must be something he wants them to grasp about who God is. When I was reading this story, I noticed a couple of important things, and they all had to do with assumptions. You know what people say about like making an assumption? I won't say it's because it's church, Joe, okay? But you know what I'm talking about. There's three important things happening here that we need to ask. There are things that we assume about ourselves. There are things that we assume about others. And there are things that we assume about God. And as we walk towards this series this fall about who God is and why we care to follow him, the first thing that I think you have to do is start with your assumptions. There's this really interesting line of study that's come out over like the last decade of like sociology projects, where they've determined that this is like an insane number, but 90% of the assumptions that we make about other people and about a situation are wrong. Let's cut that in half. Let's say that those scientists are so proud of their study and they bump the numbers up. Let's say it's 50%. 50% of the things that you think about other people and about a situation are wrong. But this becomes our truth, and this becomes the way that we interact with the world. I think that we can safely assume that the assumptions that we have about God might fall into that same category of numbers. That the things that we assume about God might not be right about God, and instead might be stories that we have been telling ourselves for so long that now they're true. And our opinion has become fact, and our fact has driven our whole life. Think about some assumptions that the younger son is making. One is he's assuming it's going to be more fun away from home than it is at home, which is familiar. I said we're going to read this like a mirror, and some of you felt really seen by the younger son, and some of you felt really seen by the older son. I spent a lot of my young life feeling very much like the younger son, ignoring phone calls from my family and running very far away from who they were and what they thought was true. And some of the assumptions that we make as the younger son is that his money was more important than the one who would provide the money. So it wasn't the relationship with his father that would provide for him, it was his father's stuff. And once he had his father's stuff, he could go and he could provide for himself with his father's resources. There didn't need to be any relationship connected to that. He also makes an assumption about what he really needs, which is food and parties and women and wild, I love that term, wild living. That's like a warning I would get from my grandma. Oh, don't watch your wild living. He thought that his needs were like a word that we would give it would just be appetite, like pure appetite for all that the world could make him feel. He wanted to feel something new. But we know that what he really needed, because we know that what we really need is to belong to a family and to be near to love. But it can be really hard to see what we need when we think we're providing for ourselves. And we're pretty good at providing for ourselves. We think it's just part of being a grown-up. You just start providing for yourself. But then we run out of what we need to provide for ourselves. And so then, just like the younger son, we survive on scraps. And suddenly, we are surviving on scraps of friendships. Maybe scraps of a marriage. Scraps of an addiction. Scraps of approval from other people. What I find really interesting about the son is that once he's blown through all this money, he doesn't expect anything more than what's in front of him. We will eat what was meant for the pigs before we will admit that we are lost. Because to admit that we are lost means that we couldn't provide. And then there's this really heartbreaking thing that happens that I haven't really noticed before in verses 17 and 19. Andrew, I know I said I was going to use this clicker, but boy, am I not. Can you go back to 17 and 19? He rehearses his speech. Is this familiar to you, by the way, that you would rehearse a speech before you go to someone? Do any of you guys do this? We all do. We're like in a fight with someone who doesn't know we're in a fight with them yet, and so we're like practicing it in our head. Or we think that someone's mad at us, and so we're rehearsing a defense of ourselves, even though they haven't told us that they're mad at us yet. Gosh, so he is rehearsing the speech that he's going to give to his dad. I've sinned against you in heaven. I've sinned against you in heaven. I don't need to be a son anymore. I don't need to be a son anymore. I'm not going to ask him for sonship back. That'd be crazy. I took all of his money, but I could at least be one of his servants. He doesn't even consider himself a son anymore. He doesn't say, my brother is eating just fine at home. He says, my father's servants are eating just fine at home. He immediately identifies with the servants because he assumes that his sin has equaled loss of privilege, loss of access, loss of identity, loss of worth. Loss of belonging. He assumes that his sin has written him out of his father's story, and so he's going to have to find a new way into the story as a servant. And so then he goes to his father and he tries, this is funny to me too, he tells his father how to feel about him. Like, I've done wrong. you don't need to feel sorry for me or let me in as a son. You know, he's like using that phrase. He's trying to control the narrative. We do this too in relationships. Like, I'll tell you how to feel about me, and I will tell you how to react to me. And his father doesn't even answer him. I love this. Jesus does this a lot in stories. Someone says something and he answers a totally different question. The father runs out to him. He doesn't say, let's talk about what you've done. Are you sorry? Are you never going to do this again? Do you understand that you've used my money? Do you understand that there's less for the family now? Do you? Okay, then you can come back home. What does he do? Here's a robe. Here's a ring. Here's sandals for your feet. We're going to kill a calf. It's so above and beyond the script that the son has written. It's so above and beyond the assumptions that he has made about his sin. And so the father comes out and says, come back. I love you. Let's have a party. And then the camera zooms out to the fields. We're on the party. Everyone's having a great time. Who's out in the field? You responsible oldest children. Doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. I can't imagine that his workload was less when his brother left. He's doing the work of two sons now. He's carrying the weight of the family. And he hears this parting and he says, I love that he doesn't even go in. This also is such an oldest child move to me. Like, what's happening in that house? Like, they're not going to go into the party because it might be the wrong party or whatever, you know? Like, oh, I better make sure it's fine before I go in. So he grabs a servant and says, what's going on? Your brother's back. He is furious. And what's interesting is that the assumptions that the first son made about his identity, the older son confirms. He does not call him his brother. He says, this son of yours. This is powerful. Because some of what the younger son imagined was happening was happening. It just wasn't happening with his father. But his brother doesn't even call him his kin. He says, this son of yours wasted your money. But he doesn't just point to what the younger son did. What else does he need his dad to know? What he did. Hello, I've been working out here this whole time. I don't get a party. I couldn't even have a goat. This is like my kids. They don't say goat, though. Why'd you get that for her? Both sons are operating under their own assumptions. Assumptions about their father, assumption about resources, assumptions about their identities, and assumptions about their worth. Because the older son's worth was so tied to his place in the field. And what's really interesting to me is that both boys' worth is tied to a thing away from their father. The older son's identity is in the field. It is not in the house. Otherwise, he'd be at the party. The younger son's identity is to go away and to please his flesh. It is not in the house of his father. Neither boy has recognized that who they are and their belovedness is centered in the presence of their father, not in his things, not in his work, in his presence. And it might be tempting to think that this story is about one son, but it's about two sons. And their assumptions approach even how their assumptions facilitate their approach to their father. The father says to the older son, I will give you everything. And my thought would be, I wonder if he just didn't ask. Like, do you think he was begging his father for a party with his friends? Because it doesn't seem like it. So he assumes that, God, this is so familiar. I'm married to this person too. He assumes that his work, the things that he does right, should be noticed and rewarded. He should not have to ask for it. He has earned it. He has earned his father's love. And to feel that love withhold is a slap in the face to the work that he's done. Not only that, but to feel like you're serving this withholding father and then to be wildly wrong because now you're looking at a party for a son who has done nothing. Your whole world has just been turned upside down because that kid didn't earn a party. But here he is anyways. So the older son is also in this deep identity crisis. Both of them are. They're both attempting to provide for themselves. They're both attempting to find acceptance from their father in a way that they control. And how's that working out for them? This is a parable, which means that Jesus is telling it for the people who are listening to recognize something, a seed of a truth in the story. And the people that he's telling the story to are the Pharisees and the sinners he's been eating with. Do you think they recognize themselves in the story a little bit? I mean, they did kill him later, so probably. They didn't love Jesus' stories. But the seed of truth in this parable is that the assumptions that we have about what we deserve and the assumptions we have about what other people deserve say a lot about our assumptions about God. And if we know that we can tell ourselves a story for a very long time and have it become truth, maybe part of what Jesus is asking us to do is to look at our assumptions about him and to look at our assumptions about our Father. I would love if changing our assumptions about each other would change our assumptions about God, but I think it's the other way around. We have to know who the Father is in order to recognize how he sees you. We have to know who the Father is to recognize how he sees us. Will you put up that quote from Eugene Peterson? He has this book called Tell It Slant, where he walks through the parables. I really love it. And he has this quote about this parable. For as long as we hold on to any pretense of having it all together, we are prevented from deepening and maturing in the Christian faith. For as long as we avoid any recognition of our lostness, we are prevented from experiencing the elegant profundities of fondness, which is a very poetic way of saying the depth of love. For as long as we insist on maintaining safe moral grids in which we always know where we stand and where everyone else stands, these poses of self-sufficiency, we disenfranchise ourselves from the company of the found sheep, the found coin, the two found brothers, and the celebrating angels. Somewhere in there is me, and somewhere in there is you, and somewhere in there is an assumption about what God has for you. We assume that God's goodness is limited. We assume that we have to earn his resources. And we assume that he should do the same for everyone else. Because it's not fair if he doesn't. We want God's love to be fair by our standards. These are the grids that we want to set up. A grid for me, a grid for you, a grid for God. Don't you dare cross it. But the father in this story shatters all of their assumptions. Here's what's really powerful to me. Because running to the son on the road has always meant a lot to me as a girl on the road. But you know who he also goes out to is the older son. He doesn't wait in the party hoping that he'll come in. He goes out and pleads with him. God runs to both sons. God runs to both daughters because both are trapped in their assumptions about what he has for them. This is a parable about a God who pursues us. And this is a parable about us laying down our assumptions, facing our lostness, and coming back to the party. You guys know I love a party. I'm obviously going to preach anytime there's a party involved. Being with God, being in the presence of a good father is enough. It wasn't about the inheritance. It wasn't about the fattened calf. It wasn't about being a servant or a son. It was about being in the presence of the one who loved them. So we're going to wrap up today asking ourselves a couple questions about our assumptions. Do you assume that God is withholding from you? Do you assume that you have to earn his love back after you fail? Do you assume that others are less deserving of his grace or yours? Do we assume that joy is scarce and that God can't bless you if you already blessed someone else? My encouragement to us, to me, is to walk with Jesus just like these Pharisees and sinners were walking with Jesus and listen to his stories. Go read one of the Gospels. And I'll tell you what you're going to see. I want you to do it, but I'm going to tell you what you're going to see. You're going to see that with Jesus, you get to belong before you believe, and you get access before you accept him. This is an unbelievable truth about Jesus, and I will stand by it till the day I die. You get to belong with Jesus before you believe. You get to come to his presence. You get to pray. You get to tell him how you feel. And you get access to the God of the universe before you have even fully accepted that the God of the universe exists. You don't have to believe in God before he believes in you. Jesus says, "Test me, try me, taste and see that the Lord is good." So Jesus, wherever we saw ourselves in this story today, great news, you came after all of us. We were the sheep, we were the coin, we were the brother. And you did not stop. You didn't stop till you found us and brought us home. It is the nearness of you that is what we need. And it is in your presence that we understand who we are, Lord. So for those of us who are working hard out in the field, grumpy, for those of us who have outlasted our resources and are living on scraps, we turn our faces to you. We want to come home. We want to be found. during this last song, we're going to come forward and take communion, and the elements of communion are a homecoming. But mostly they are the robe and the ring and the sandals. This is the provision. The blood and the body of Christ is what made it possible for us to join that family with zero earning. So come, take the elements of communion, and tell your Father that you are so glad that He has welcomed you home.
Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe to get the weekly episodes in your podcast feed. You can find out more on how to get connected with Redemption Hill at redemptionboise.org/connection, where you can fill out the Connect card and start your journey today. For regular encouragement throughout the week, follow us on Instagram at Redemption Boise. We are so glad you're here and are excited to accompany you in your story with God. We hope to see you soon.